Accession number 23149, Wheel 4.
Mr. Pat Sensen, Wheel 4. What were the weather conditions like out there? Were there any?
Pretty bad. When I was out in India, the there were these enormous clouds that went up from about 2,000 feet to about 30,000 feet. I mean, you just couldn't get through them. So we used to sometimes we just flew below them at about 2,000 feet or less, really. That was the only way to get through. Or if they came up when we'd got a bit of height, then we'd fly around them. But that was quite interesting, because there are these mountainous clouds of full of lightning or flashing away, and we were flying through them like this. You know, it was very interesting, but the weather was pretty bad. It didn't really affect us very much, to be honest.
Did the humidity affect the planes at all?
Yes, they did. I think the didn't affect the Liberator so much, but aircraft like the Mosquito, which was a wooden aircraft, it used to be very badly affected out there. But Liberators were pretty safe. I think the humidity used to affect the crews more than anything else. I mean, it was terribly, terribly sticky. During the monsoon, we used to sit. Those of us weren't on duty. We'd be lying on our beds in the huts, and then the rain had come, and we'd just strip off and rush out into the rain, you know, just to get cool. But in the monsoon period, it was very awkward, very, very nasty.
What was the food like out there?
Pretty bad. We had soya links, which were sort of sausages. We had bacon and eggs. We had a lot of bacon and eggs. Remember, flying breakfast used to be bacon, eggs, sausage or soya links, bacon, eggs, fried bread, tomatoes, and beans. And that used to be a most inappropriate breakfast, really, for flying, and we'd take off with that. But the food was passable. I mean, we were none of us gourmets. We just enjoyed it. Mind you, we had some good food when we went to Calcutta on leave, but generally the food was adequate.
When you took off on long flights, would you have taken, say, flasks and food with you?
Oh, yes, we had. I think we had American K rations that we used to take. We used to get them from the Americans at Villanova. They were quite a delicacy. They had some beautiful cheese in some of them. And they had these self-heating tins of coffee as well, which were rather nice. And so we used to load up with those.
Quite sustaining, I should think.
Yeah. They were very good. But I haven't got a real recollection of the food, except the flying breakfasts.
Just going back to when you did your training, did you ever do an oxygen climb?
A what?
Oxygen climb?
No. Never had an oxygen mask on in the whole of my career.
And what about air firing exercises? Did you have to take part in that?
No. Well, I didn't. When I got onto Liberators, we used to do a bit of air firing. But see, I think if you're going to practice air gunnery, you've got to have a tow. You've got to have someone towing a target. And I think, I remember we used to, it used to be impressed upon us to use as little petrol or aviation fuel as possible. We used to sort of run a little competition amongst ourselves, who would come back with the most fuel. And so I think that there was a general shortage of it, so you didn't have you couldn't have an aircraft pulling a target. And anyway, you see, when I got out there in late 44, there was very little Japanese activity anyway, so there was nothing really to fire at. The only thing was when we went out strafing. And
could you describe exactly what strafing is?
Well, we'd fly around at about, we'd fly at about 1,000 feet. And then you'd see, you know, if you were very lucky, you'd see a train. And so you alerted, we had two gunners on those trips, so you'd alert them, and you'd come around and fly as close as possible to the train, really. I mean, as low down and as close as you could get. And you went past and you just strafed them. Or if you had some small bombs on, as we did, we'd drop a bomb on them, you know. And that was quite effective. I remember we were flying on one of these long trips, and we were looking for targets of opportunity, and we were flying in the Gulf of what was called the Gulf of Siam in those days, and there was a sizable steamer, which is the most unusual, and there were two of us, two aircraft, and we dropped a couple of bombs on that and set it on fire, and it was sinking when we left it. You know, it was almost like a game, really. It really was. It was, you know, we used to laugh about it when we came back, you know. Never thought about the people on board.
What do you think are the foremost qualities that comprise good leadership?
Well, I don't know. I'm trying to think of Wing Commander Blackburn, who was the CO of 159. It all stems from a presence, I think. That's the first thing. You've got to look like a leader. You've got to behave like a leader. You've got to show consideration for people. You've got to be fair. You've got to be strong-minded. That's absolutely essential. But it's something which is born. Some people are born with. I don't think you can acquire a leadership quality if either got it or you haven't.
To what extent do you feel, because you were a leader at one stage, weren't you? What responsibility do you feel with the men that are with you?
Well, the only time I suppose I was leader of the DDT flight, and I was a leader when we came back from Ceylon. I think you had to be there for people to talk to, and when they talked to you, you had to listen, and you had to give them your view. I mean, you can say when in my business career, I mean, I've been a leader in that, if you like, and people used to say to me, what shall I do? And I'd always come back with, well, what do you think you ought to do? And then talk to them about it, and then do it. There's leadership by example, of course. I mean, that was how Wing Commander Blackburn was a great leader. He was he led by example. I mean, when we eventually got to this 68,000 pound all up weight, he said, we were at Piadoba, he said, now, I'm going off first. If I don't make it, abort the whole thing. Now, that was leadership. I mean, that was just courage, really. But you have to set an example. And
are there any times that stand out more in your memory, your experiences?
Well, only those that I've talked about, really. I think I think most of the things that I've already mentioned. No, as I said several times before, it was just a very exciting time, and although one really shouldn't say it, I really thoroughly enjoyed my career in the RAF. It was great. In fact, as I said at lunchtime, when I would have stayed in, I would have taken a permanent commission if I could have got one. I'd have taken a permanent commission and stayed in after the war, but for the reasons I gave you at lunchtime, I didn't do it.
Did you continue flying?
No, I came out of the RAF in 19. I was married in October 46, and I came out of the Air Force just after that, and I. As I said, I went into a job. I had no training. I could have gone back to university, but I was married and I felt I had to earn the keep. So I got the job as a salesman, and £35 a month, and just went from there. And I was 22 then, and my daughter was born in 47. So she's 55 this year. And anyway, I joined the soap firm and progressed there and became a senior sales manager there. Then I went to the GEC and finished up as a GEC director because, you know, again, all of it, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
It involved travel?
Pardon?
It involved travel.
Yes, I did. I travelled a lot. Mm. Yeah, we had branches all over the world, and I used to go see most of them.
Did you ever get back to the places where you were stationed?
Only in South Africa. I went back to Potchefstroom once, and I couldn't remember it. Didn't. Since then, I've been back to Perth in Scotland and went to the airfield there, and where we spent a little time after I was commissioned, killing time really, just flying around. I remember that was quite, but I haven't been to anywhere else. I haven't tried to go.
I meant to ask you, did you ever carry any photographers on board?
No.
Did you take photographs yourself while you were overseas?
Oh, I took a lot of photographs, yeah, but they went up in the fire.
Did you talk about that?
What?
The fire.
About the fire? Mm-hmm. Well, it was 1997 and 17th of April, and the I was up in the middle of the night and making a noise, mucking about. My wife put the light on and we saw the wallpaper coming off the wall. And I went outside, I called the fire brigade, I went outside to make sure the fire brigade knew which house it was. And I looked back and I saw the flames coming out of the garage, so I rushed back in and got my wife and my son out, and the dog and the cat. And by the time the fire brigade came, which was about 10 minutes after that, the place was well ablaze. And the two top floors went. Of course, the loft was, that's why I had the letters and the photographs and the logbooks and everything else, they all went up in smoke.
Could you just explain what letters?
Well, there were letters from my first wife. The lady I married in 1946 died in 1968. We wrote, there must have been 500 letters. We wrote most days to each other, and I kept her letters and she kept mine, and then when we got back, I never even read them through. We put them all in the suitcase and put them there, and it was a sort of talisman, really. And it was in the loft, and like everything else, it just went. And the photographs, there are a lot of photographs of that I took in India, of generally speaking, of friends, of groups of people, and which would have been good for my memory today, but there are. And of course, a lot of slides of holidays that we'd taken, my daughter and my wife and myself. And they all went. And after my wife died, I married again I married in 1972, and that lady is still looking after me, I'm happy to say.
It must have taken you quite a while to come to terms with this loss, with the loss of all these very precious items.
It did, yes, but I don't know. People said to my wife and I think you're marvellous. I think you're marvellous the way you haven't let it get you down. And yes, it was very sad that they went, and it's got sadder as it got farther away, if you know what I mean. But the loss of the jewellery was unfortunate, but you know, my wife hasn't really bothered too much about that, and she's got a few little pieces that we've bought since, and she doesn't seem to let it affect her, and I don't. But it's just, it's certainly a trauma. It was very very upsetting at the time, but there are. Had to go on living. Life goes on. I've never lost my love of flying, and after my first wife died in 1968, I decided I'd like to fly again. So I went to the local flying school, which is at Denham, I found it was like riding a bicycle. It was, you know, once you've done it, you can always do it. And I did the requisite number of hours, and I'd done the cross countries and everything, you know, because it was an absolute piece of cake, and I was thoroughly enjoying it. And then I had to go for a test to get my private pilot's license. But before I do that, I had to have a medical. And I'd never had any medical trouble in my life. I'd had, you know, bit of sinus trouble, that was all. And I had the medical, everything went well, and the chap was just signing my form, but the nurse ran in and said, doctor, we have a problem. And that was the diabetes. And I was diagnosed with diabetes. And that really put the costs of flying up enormously because of insurance. And in fact, I had insurance refused then, so I decided I had to pack it up. So I didn't actually get my private pilot's license, but I got about 30 hours flying in, which I thoroughly enjoyed. That was in 1970, I think.
That's a long time to be non-flying.
Mm. Yeah, it's about nearly 25 years, and it was just like riding a bike. Since then, I've done a bit of gliding. I went on a gliding course at High Wycombe and thoroughly enjoyed that. That was great fun. But that's all over now, I think. That was about 2 or 3 years ago I did the gliding. But
Have you ever flown helicopters?
I've had a couple of trial flights in helicopters, and I found it very, very good fun, but I was totally out of sync. It must be a totally different technique flying a helicopter to flying a fixed wing aircraft. And I've only been up for half an hour a couple of times, had a go at trying to fly it, and I was hopeless. A bit like when I started flying and I didn't think I was going to be a pilot. That was all over again.
What do you like if you say when you used to go to Australia on business? How did you cope with those flights?
I've always enjoyed them, but there was one quite interesting. I hope you'll find it interesting. I went to Australia via Calcutta, Middle Eastern Calcutta, and Singapore. And this was in the 707 days, the Boeing 707. And we were flying from Calcutta to Singapore, and I said to the stewardess, "Do you think I could come up to the front?" I was travelling business class, I think. "Then come up to the front, because I used to fly along this route during the war." And she said, "I'll ask the pilot." I had a word, and she had a word. She said, "Come on up." And the second pilot got out of his seat, and I sat in the second pilot's seat, and we started talking about flying. You know what it's like. You know, open the hangar doors. And I'd say, "Oh yeah, that's the Sundarbans. That's where we used to take at that point. That's where we used to take a last sight before we set off down the Bay of Bengal. You know, oh, big stuff." And we chatted away, and we chatted for about 3 or 4 hours, I think. Oh, it was a long time. And I said, "I think I'd better get back to the seat." And I got back to my seat, and I was travelling with a group of people from the London Chamber of Commerce, I think. And as soon as I got back to the seat, they said, "This is your captain speaking." He said something like, "I've just had a very interesting chat with a passenger who used to fly here during the war." And he went on about it. And these people were saying to me, the other people in the group saying, "Oh, you know, how nice to fly with a hero, you know. And will you sign my menu, please?" You know, it was very embarrassing, But I quite enjoy flying now. I've been on Concorde a few times, and that was fun. And we went to Portugal for the weekend a few weeks ago, and I thought there was a very, very strong crosswind, and I was sitting at the back of the aircraft. And I thought the bloke had lost it. I thought we were going to have trouble. I really was quite frightened, because the back was going like this, and I thought he'd lost control of it at one stage, but no, it went off all right. But that's the only time I can think of ever being worried enough. Yeah, but that was only a matter of a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm not nervous of flying, really. Yeah, if you want to. On the troop ship going out to India, I had my 20th birthday. And we, you know, as far as you could on a troop ship, we had a little party. And there were a lot of wrens on board. And one of the wrens was a fortune teller with tarot cards. And she was going around the table, everybody was having their fortune told, and it came to me. And she put the cards down, and then she put them back again. And I said, "Well, come on, no, I'm not going to tell you." And I said, "Why won't you tell me?" He said, no, forget it. I'm not going to, you know, there's nothing on the cards. I said, "There was something on the cards. What was it?" And she said, "Well, if you really want to know, you're not going to live beyond 40. I said, really? And I just laughed at her, you know, I said, that'd be stupid. You know, but that was a nice thing to have said to you on your 20th birthday when you're going out to single-handedly to fight the Japanese.
Actually, that makes me think of a story that I read in, I think it was Guy Gibson's book, where he said that he had a couple of dental appointments that he didn't attend. And after about the fourth time, he knew he had to make this dental appointment. And the dentist said, why haven't you kept your appointments? He said, we all think it's not worth it, that we're not going to live anyway. And I thought that was a very sad little story.
Yeah.
And wondered, you know, in your experience, did you know many who felt that way?
I don't think so. We never got around to, I mean, we were all of us kids. We weren't getting a, we never got around to any philosophical or metaphysical chat. You know, we never really analysed what we were doing or anything else. We'd make fun, you know, we'd say things like, well, I'm not going to do any more operations when I've finished my tour, I'm packing up, I'm doing no more. And we used to say that. And then at the end of the tour, we'd stay on and do some more. You know, that was the nearest thing we got to ever really thinking about it. I'm talking about myself, but of course there were a lot of older people on the squadron. I mean, I had my crew at one time were myself. I was about 21, and three 35 to 40s, 40-year-olds, and I really was the baby, you know, the baby of the crew. And they might have, they being older and being more sensible and not just being wild about flying like I was, they might have had thoughts, but they never conveyed them.
I think, like you said at the beginning as well, it was a different sort of war in Europe.
Oh yeah. I mean,
yeah.
We heard of people. Losing their lives, but it was generally because of a crash. You know, I remember, I think it was 215 Squadron, a great friend of mine, a chap called Booth, can't remember his first name now, I was quite hit when I heard that he was killed, but he was killed in hit another aircraft when they were flying over a target, you know, but there were no great casualties. Which was due to my father and a chap turning over two pages in the book in Durban.
Fate.
Funny, isn't it? Yep.
Well, that's very timely because that's the end of Reel 4.
Okay, fine. Good.